You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. The Review is brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Hello and a very warm welcome to The Review, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald and Gillian De Bias. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be talking about and listening to the finest new pop music with Peter Robinson from Pop Justice.
And this week, once again, we'll be touring bookshops around the world. Today, we travel to Beirut, Rome and Dublin.
The Gutter Bookshop is named after the famous Oscar Wilde quote, "We're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars."
That was Bob Johnston from the Gutter Bookshop in Dublin.
And joining us in the studio for our weekly magazine review will be Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture.
We'll also speak to architect David Cohn about his latest creation, a boat hotel perched on a London landmark.
All this and more right here on The Review. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald and Gillian De Bias. Hello. Good morning, Gillian.
Hello, Hugo.
It's good afternoon in London, isn't it?
Yes, and nice to have you here in Tyler's hot seat.
I know, the cuckoo.
Yeah, well, I guess he's now in LA.
Is he in LA or is he in the air, actually, as we speak?
He could be en route to Japan.
It can be difficult to keep track.
Yeah, exactly. But I hear you're going on a trip. Where are you heading?
I am. I'm off to Cologne on Monday. It's the start of the big fair circuit in the design industry, and it always kicks off at the beginning of January with Cologne, which this year is still bigger than ever, I think, because the German market is so strong. So many of the big sort of global design companies have trolleyed their latest creations to Cologne, hoping to take a bit of Chinese
How does it
money.
Differ from, say, Milan Saloni? Is it
far more business oriented? Mm. It's not so much about standing around in the streets with a glass of champagne. It's much more about talking business and endless Excel spreadsheets in the fairgrounds.
And then you move on from Cologne.
And then from Cologne, I'm going to Zurich for a series of meetings with various people in the architecture and design world. And then from Zurich, I'm going to Rome.
Ah.
So I'm going on a little mini European tour myself.
Do you feel it is a bit like, you know, January 2012? It's the back to school, it's the start of a new
Definitely.
Sort of design
It always
year.
Does feel like that. And it's funny, like, Cologne is a beautiful city. Mm. It's always freezing in January.
Mm-hmm. Dress warm, pack warm.
I know, exactly. I'm going to be doing my packing after this. But it kickstarts the year. Everybody is always very optimistic. Mm-hmm. Even in the last couple of years when business has been tough. Mm. It's sort of new year, new cycle for the industry.
It's a bit like the film industry too, because I was looking at the papers and come January we have the Golden Globes.
Exactly.
We have Sundance Film Festival. We have the Oscar nominations. And I was particularly interested in the Financial Times today. There was an article on the back of Cameron's visit to Pinewood Studios and a new review coming out on whether how much the government should support the industry. And there's the whole debate. Is it art? Should it be subsidized? Or is it entrepreneurial?
Yeah.
And good timing because Jonathan and I are working on a program for the entrepreneurs, which is just very much about new and alternative ways of funding films.
Have you seen a lot of the big films that are at the
awards? Not enough.
No, me neither. It always sort of comes very quickly, doesn't it?
I know. The Ides of March I saw, and I was looking actually at the list of films up for this year, and the film Hugo is up for Best Film for the Golden Globe. So
Nothing
I hope it wins, Hugo. Well, maybe we should move on. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24, and it's time to hear what's flying off the shelves at independent bookshops around the world.
This week we sent our correspondents to their local bookshops in Beirut, Rome and Dublin, so we're going to start with Beirut.
My name is Chantal Sfer. I'm assistant manager and a bookseller in this store in Librairie El Bourge. I've loved books since I was very, very little. It was only recently that I decided to study a master in what we call at USG Métier du Livre, that is everything about the book industry. El Bourge, the bookshop, was opened in December 2003. It's located in what used to be called the Bourge Square, which is at the moment next to the main square of downtown. The bookshop is divided two floors. Downstairs we have a little bit of quality stationery, the literature, the Lebanese section, history and politics. And upstairs we have comic books, art books, self-development books and youth books. We sell English books, French books and Arabic books. We try to bring things that others don't, not to be better, but just to be different. It could be in our comic books, we try to encourage small independent publishing books, publishing editors. What always does well is our section on Lebanon. People come and ask for Lebanese authors, from Hanan al-Sheikh to Amin Ma'louf to Rashida al-Da'if, whether it is in French, in English, and in Arabic. You need to be aware about all three cultures. Most people like to read in the original language, so if they're capable of reading the book in English, they'll probably read it in English and not the translation that's made in French or in Arabic.
That was Chantal Sphere from the Al Bourj bookshop in Beirut. And Hugo, don't you just love the fact that she had a master's in the métier of livre?
Wonderful. What a life.
I know.
It's one of my New Year's resolutions is to go back to Beirut this year.
It's wonderful. And we talk about the, you know, paper cup where they have all those wonderful magazines.
And there's just something, I mean, I know that you love Beirut as well, don't you? But that lifestyle of little streets and sort of hot sitting outside and then going inside to the sort of cool marble floored halls and things.
And there's that great quality of life where they really do. They have this great hospitality. They eat well.
Exactly.
They have an appreciation of culture and business, but also they do play very hard.
They do play hard too, I know. Well, next up, shall we go to Rome?
Oh, yes, indeed.
I'm Giorgio Lagorte from Giuffa Bookshop Cafe in San Lorenzo, Roma, Italy. It is a small bookstore pretty much dedicated to independent literature and multiculturalism. The place has some character, you know, at least we believe so. At first, when we were setting up the store, we tried to put a little bit of our heart into it. Our best sellers are Asterius Polyp. This is by David Mazzucchelli from the United States, and it is an illustrated book. The second one I would mention is Bestiario Universale. This is from Spain, and once again, this is an illustrated book. It very much resembles mix and match books that people should be familiar, at least in the United States. A third one I would mention is 1Q84. This was the best seller in Japan in 2009 by Murakami Haruki. This came to the market as a trilogy. We actually have books 1 and 2 edited by Einaudi, which is a big editor in Italy. And 2012 we'll see also the third book by this author. And this is quite a sophisticated, intricated fiction, which had enormous success in Japan and all over the world afterwards. We have one special book coming this year, and this is from a writer who's actually coming here very often. She's a friend. Her name is Paola Soriga, and the name of the book is Dove Finisce Roma. The book is about the end of the Second World War here in Rome. Basically, she goes from area to area in this town, telling stories and showing what it probably felt like at the time. I'm going to talk about three books that we are displaying. They are all from the United States. One is named A Visit from the Good Squad by Jennifer Egan. And this won the Pulitzer Prize in 2011 for fiction. Another one is The Paris Review. The Paris Review is a notorious literary magazine from New York. And Fandango has just edited the entire collection of their works and interviews, and this covers more than half a century of publications. The third one is The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides. It's a novel. It's having a great appreciation in our bookstore.
That was Giorgio La Corta from Guifa Bookshop in San Lorenzo, Rome. I'm interested that you're going to Rome, Hugo. Do you know it well?
I do, actually. My mother grew up in Rome. And so she's always taken me there from a very young age. Mm. And it's a city that, I mean, obviously Italy's capital. But compared to Milan, Florence, Venice, I always feel like Rome is sort of slightly out on a limb. People sort of don't go there really as much for business as they would do to Milan, say. And it doesn't really have the tourist pull of sort of Florence or Venice so much. But it's having a bit of a renaissance at the moment, I think.
What about, I'm interested, is there the same rivalry between sort of, let's say, New York has with LA? Does Milan and Rome kind of battle it out?
Definitely. I mean, Milan is the business capital of Italy. Rome, I think people think of it as being a little bit stuck in its ways. But the Renaissance that I speak of is largely due to Zaha Hadid, or symptomatic of Zaha Hadid's building of the new Maxi art gallery. And I haven't been there to see it. So it's interesting.
I was talking to a correspondent there who was saying that they're trying to beef up the Rome Fashion Week this February. It will never be like Milan, of course. But it's interesting. I think it has a lot of support from the city of Rome.
Definitely.
As well.
There's sort of whole new generation of young designers and architects and fashion designers as well who are beginning to sort of put their hands up and say, you know, we can be counted here too as well. We don't all have to move to Milan to be a part of it.
Okay, well, I'll be keen when you come back.
I know. Gosh, I'm so looking forward to it. But before I go to Rome, let's go to Dublin.
My name's Bob Johnston. I'm the owner of the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar in Dublin. We've been open here for just over 2 years now, and we're a completely independent bookshop. I've worked in the book trade for something like 25 years now. I look a lot younger than I feel sometimes. And it's going incredibly well. Good afternoon, Gutter Bookshop. Oh, okay. Have you ordered a book from us? We're called the Gutter Bookshop, and I think people always expect it to be a small, dark, little, pokey shop, like everybody thinks bookshops always are. And we're not. We're very open. We're bright. All our shelving is white. We have big windows, so we have a lot of light in the shop. And people often compliment us on how light and airy and what a lovely atmosphere there is in the shop. The other thing we wanted to make sure of was when we did the shop, that we put all of the book units on wheels. So when we have events or book launches, we just wheel all the furniture out of the way and suddenly we have a big open shop that we can fit 100, 150 people into. So we can do lots of events and launches and all kinds of stuff going on in the shop. We have a bit of an Oscar Wilde shrine in the shop because obviously the Gutter Bookshop is named after the famous Oscar Wilde quote, "We're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars." And again, we have a big poster with that in the window and lots of Oscar Wilde books in the window that make the point that we are an Irish bookshop, but also that we're a bit quirky and that we're named in a very positive, hopefully, and a very inspiring fashion. And again, that kind of draws people into the shop and makes them realise that actually we're slightly different. Oh, and it's 34 sterling plus shipping, so it's going to come in at 50 sterling. Our biggest selling books in the shop are always our own staff picks. We have a large staff pick section. Everybody who works here is a big reader and loves recommending books to people. And I think that's why people keep coming back to us. I was looking at our sales for 2011, and out of the top 20 of the books that we sold, over 15 of them were actually staff picks, ones that we'd picked out specially and wanted to recommend to our customers. So actually our biggest seller for 2011 was a book called Opening Skinner's Box by Lauren Slater. And that's a book of psychological experiments. So it's very different than you'd expect to find in other bookshops. And it just strikes a chord with our kind of customers. It's interesting, it's different, and it's a little bit quirky.
Where's your pop-up children's book? Looking for a specific one.
Which one are you looking for?
It's called The Haunted House.
There's some great writing again coming this year. A big one for us will be the new John Banville literary novel, which is due out in July, and it's called Ancient Light. John Banville's actually a big supporter of us in the shop and comes in regularly, so it's wonderful to have a new novel coming from him. There's also a Northern Irish writer, David Park. He's a literary writer, and his new novel's out in March. It's called The Light of Amsterdam. Again, a wonderful Irish writer. never quite sells as well as we'd like him to, but hopefully this will be the one which people will pick up and read, because he's such a good writer. It's just a stunning story, so it's one I'll be recommending a lot in the Gutter Bookshop this year.
That was Bob Johnston from the Gutter Bookshop in Dublin.
And from books to music, our global review continues with a preview from the front line of pop music right after this.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J. Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24.
And it's the time in the programme that we talk music. So we have on the phone the editor of Pop Justice, Peter Robinson. Peter, hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could start by just sort of giving us a little rundown. What is Pop Justice?
Pop Justice is a website that I started about 10 years ago. And I've been there. I've been a freelance music journalist for a long time before that. And I was writing for people like Melody Maker and The Face and The Guardian and stuff. And at that point, pop music wasn't really covered very much in the inverted commas serious media. So when I had ideas to write about pop that I wanted to write about, there wasn't always somewhere where I could put them. So I decided to invent a place on the internet where I could just dump stuff that I wanted to say about pop music. And over the last sort of 10 years or so, it's become, it's kind of changed and kind of got bigger and sort of gone round corners and things. But it's still a place which is very sort of proud to sort of shout about pop music and to, you know, the idea of guilty pleasures, which people go, oh, I shouldn't really like this, but I do. Like, I don't believe in guilty pleasures. Like, if you love a pop song, you love a pop song, don't apologise, just love it.
And Peter, I'm a huge fan. I want to say, in the last 10 years, obviously the role of the blog has changed completely. It's gone from being sort of somewhere where people voice their own opinions to somewhere that actually really carries quite a lot of weight in the industry. You must have experienced some of that yourself with Pop Justice.
Yeah, I mean, it's all kind of by accident, really. Like I say, it was just, you know, I just sort of started it as a place to dump what I was thinking about pop music. But it was a good example of being in the right place at the right time, I suppose, and kind of being just as kind of blogs were sort of starting off. And they've become so different now. I mean, you know, Twitter is sort of, you know, it's called microblogging, isn't it? But, you know, that's you know, a way that people can kind of get their thoughts across very quickly. And Tumblr is another way of doing it. So it's a kind of like music journalism. You know, when I started off, you know, I lived in Brighton, and you know, in the south of, you know, on the south coast. And I used to have to travel to London with a disc in my hand to give my words to Melody Maker, and they would take on the disc, and then I'd go home again. Whereas these days, you just email them in. So in the time that I've been kind of writing, and it's not even that long. It's just, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years. It's changed completely, and you know, it's going to change even more in the next 15 years. So it's quite exciting to be in the middle of it.
Definitely. Now you've chosen a couple of songs to play for us. Should we start with Amanda Mayer?
Let's do that, yes.
Brilliant. This is Doubt.
Peter, what a great soundtrack for a Saturday. Can you tell us a little bit about Amanda Mayer?
Well, I first came across her start of last year, and she had a free download up called House, which I thought was quite good, and did a bit of digging. Basically, she's 15 years old.
I think
she was 15 when she recorded that, but she's 16 now. So,
gosh.
You know, she's getting on a bit. and she's from Sweden. She's signed to this quite sort of prolific and very, very good Swedish indie label called Labrador.
Ticks all the boxes.
She does tick all the boxes.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm twice as old as she is. So I would say,
young.
But a youngster I know said that she was very good looking, so I will take their word.
So do you, I mean, by discovering people like this who may have otherwise been in sort of the graveyard of pop music, have you changed careers? Have you shaped careers by reinvigorating them through Pop Justice?
Well, I've probably ruined a few. it's kind of hard to, it's kind of, you know, that kind of thing about, oh, you should dance like no one's watching. Like, I've always think you should kind of write as if nobody's reading in a way. The point when you start going, oh, I'm really important and I can shape careers, is that things start going a bit wrong, I think. So I really enjoy telling people and telling my friends about great music. And I suppose, having a website and being a music journalist is a way of telling lots of people at the same time about great music. So I just kind of like to sort of share things that I love.
Brilliant.
Some people don't like everything I love, but not to worry.
Should we go to the next song? This is Nicola Roberts, familiar name. This is Yo-Yo. That was Yo-Yo by Nicola Roberts. And Peter, Nicola was obviously a member of Girls Aloud, or is a member of Girls Aloud, I should say.
Careful.
And she came out with her debut solo album, which got mass sort of critical acclaim across the board, didn't it? Were you a fan?
Yes, I'm a big fan. I mean, critical acclaim is kind of shorthand for saying nobody bought it. some people bought it, and lots of people loved it. And I think, like, Nicola has this kind of very odd role in pop over the last 10 years, because when she joined Girls, obviously Girls Aloud performed on TV and stuff, and four members of the band were quite sort of conventionally girl band material, and then there's kind of Nicola Roberts, who would always kind of find herself on the end, and she was kind of ginger and she was really young and hadn't really grown into herself, I suppose. And over the last 10 years, it's been quite interesting watching as she's kind of figured out who she is, and she stopped trying to fit in, and she started going, oh, actually, I'm amazing as I am. And she kind of made this album last year, which there's lots of songs on it about just kind of realizing who you are, I suppose. And I interviewed her a couple of years ago at the end of, end-of-the-decade interview for The Observer, the newspaper, and one of the questions I asked her was, what was the worst year out of the last decade? And she said, well, actually, I had quite a bad time between 2003 and 2007, which was basically half the decade.
Oh,
and she basically, fame hadn't really suited her, and kind of being in the spotlight hadn't suited her, and now it kind of perfectly does suit her, really. So
definitely, she's sort of seems to be the one that's come out on top, really, against all the odds, like you say.
Yeah, she's been sort of forced to figure out who she is, whereas I think maybe the other members of the band didn't really have that. It wasn't ever a decision or kind of like a route that they had to take. They kind of thought they were okay, and I think, like, she's the one who hasn't been complacent, and she's probably in a better place as a result.
Definitely. And are we going to be hearing more from Girls Aloud this year, or is that them done and dusted, do you think?
I think the general idea is, I don't know, I mean, it feels like Cheryl's kind of gearing up to have another solo album out, so I reckon Cheryl's solo album in the spring, get that out of the way, Girls Aloud reunion, not that they ever split up, at the end of the year.
That'll
be their 10 years in showbiz there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to that, definitely. Yeah. And Peter Robinson, thank you very much for sharing those two great tracks with us.
Pleasure.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
J.Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In affairs and business, there's a bit of an oil theme. We head to Accra to find out whether Ghana can escape the oil curse that has blighted its neighbours. And we visit Santos, the Brazilian city that's using its oil profits to give Sao Paulo a run for its money.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Gillian Tobias.
Now we have a fresh palette of magazines in front of us. And to help us review them this week, we're joined in studio by Jeremy Leslie, creative director of Mag Culture, the definitive blog about magazine design. Hello, Jeremy.
Good morning.
So we always love this part of the programme where we have someone opposite with us, a big pile of fresh magazines. What's on the top of your pile?
Well, I bought four magazines this morning. I've got them carefully selected into small, growing bigger as we range through.
It's a very neat pile.
My first selection is from Melbourne, Australia, and it's a motorcycle magazine called Head Full of Snakes.
Oh, gosh, I've never heard of this.
It's a new magazine, just out. It's issue one. It's published, as I say, from Melbourne. 500 copies, so this is a very, very niche, small a distribution magazine, but it's fascinating because it's one of a number of magazines that are taking on what are traditional genres of magazines and reinventing them in a very stylish and well-designed, well-produced way.
Can you just describe the look of it a bit for the
people listening? Well, it's sort of the size of it wouldn't surprise you in terms of it's more or less A4. It's perfect bound. It's on very rough matte stock, but. And the printing quality is the key to it. It's printed on a risograph machine, which means every single sheet has been printed individually and each colour has been printed individually, hence the 500 issues.
Only 500. But is there a market for 500 sort of art and motorcycle enthusiasts?
Well, it's gone down very well with designers, but it's also apparently going down very well with motorcycle enthusiasts in Australia as well.
Can I have a look at it? Yeah. It's beautiful. Gosh, I know, and it feels quite stiff, sturdy, like that might last after a motorcycle journey, being stuffed in a back pocket.
Yeah, I think it's very functional as well as good looking, but it's the opposite end. It's not a glossy photo led magazine.
It's quite robust.
But it's got a lot of content. There's a lot of pages. I haven't counted them, but it's a gorgeous magazine
and a nice mix of sort of graphics, print, photography, illustration.
Yeah, and there's a lot of there's a feature in there about 50s. Motorcycle advertising, so a lot of the pages are given over to old adverts from the 50s and stuff. So it's a beautiful piece.
Issue one, is it monthly?
Oh no!
I was going to say.
I think it probably took me about a month to print it.
That's fantastic. What else have you got there then?
So moving on from there, a particular recent favourite from Cape Town. There's a design studio there called The President that do some very interesting work. They've done a number of very interesting kind of magazines, which are almost kind of boxes of surprise goodies. This is a more traditional format magazine, but it's still very unique. It's a guide to the local food in Cape Town, which is a big foodie place anyhow. But it combines lovely typography, beautiful photography, and great information. And it has a purpose, it's a campaigning purpose behind it in terms of providing a reminder that as well as all the big kind of waterside touristy type restaurants, there are a lot of really good street restaurants there, street cafes and places where you can get really decent food. And there's just graphically, it's fantastic as well. There's great photography by a guy, I think it's Paul Ward, both of some of the people that run the restaurants, but also of food, and they're sort of expressing the idea of street food. There's a lot of food sort of just as you find it at the end of a long night. There's discarded hamburgers, discarded food, waste food, if you like. But it's sort of real food. It's the opposite end of the lifestyle food.
It's interesting. On the programme, we occasionally talk about the food magazines, and the interesting ones aren't coming out of England. They're coming out of Australia. Uh-huh. They're coming out of Cape Town. When I was in the States, I picked up Lucky Peach. And Lucky Peach, when I opened the masthead, is done by the McSweeney team in San Francisco. And again, interesting design, a little bit of irreverence, like things like little irreverent fruit labels. Great writing, like real articles, a bit of quirkiness, lots of imagination. But we're not really getting that in England, are we, in food magazines here? Do you find?
I think there are some. I think my feeling about the I think there's a lot of new food magazines at the moment because people are sort of turn in on themselves. It's harder to go out and live the big foodie lifestyle these days. I think people are cooking and wanting to enjoy food more. So you've, in the UK, you've got Fire and Knives, which I think is a beautiful magazine about food. Which looks
you'll have to bring that in.
Maybe next time I'll bring that.
I have a copy upstairs. It's fantastic.
But like the motorcycle magazine and to an extent Menu from Cape Town and Lucky Peach, it's looking these are magazines that look more at the kind of general culture and food and other areas of interest. They put them in the context rather than just deal with them as a big glossy cook this, do this, buy
food
this.
Porn.
Exactly. And there's a lot of great magazines that do that very well, but I think it's also fantastic to see an alternative growing up.
And I see that you've got a copy of Bloomberg Business Week as well.
Yes, which you have too.
We do as well. I know, with a great article called Perfect Husband on the cover.
In a baby bottle.
In a baby bottle. And it's an article that's been written several times before. All about stuff about what the new age husband is all about. But Bloomberg Business Week, to me, gets better and better. And I think it's one of the few magazines that actually manages to combine very good editorial and opinion with sort of lighter culture design and not sort of feel like it's a forced combination. And I mean, Intelligent Life, I feel sometimes flicking through that it's a slightly unhappy marriage of the two. But Bloomberg Business Week goes from strength to strength.
I agree. It's interesting you mentioned Intelligent Life, which comes from The Economist, who clearly a competitor in some respects to the Bloomberg Business Week, being a weekly kind of business-orientated title. I think Business Week's reinvented itself over the last 18, 24 months with a new art director who came from England, who'd been working on G2 at The Guardian. And I think the design and editorial twist that's been brought to it is... Remember, I mean, in the context of what we're talking about, we've been looking at some very small niche magazines. This is a big mainstream weekly, and I think the job they've done on the content and the design is fantastic.
And the covers, I think.
It's the covers that win it. The covers are astonishing. The design and art direction and the variety of illustration, photography, typography. I think there's been a tendency with the technology now that you can apply to magazines. It lets weeklies appear like monthlies, this has gone back to that weekly feel. It's very spontaneous and very well put together at the same time.
Definitely, it's always a highlight when it comes into the office each week. And have you got anything else with you?
I have one final magazine, which is a personal favourite of mine at the moment, from Berlin. It's called Monoculture, which is it comes out, I think it's quarterly now. Each issue features the work of just one person. So I've got a few here. I've got Dave Eggers' issue, Cesar Tolash, the smell artist, Miranda July, and the most recent issue is about the illustrator and comic artist Chris Ware. It's a beautiful, simple little idea. It's a small magazine. It's A5, and each one comes in a slightly different format. The consistent feature is it's about one person. There's a long sort of 5,000 to 10,000 word interview with that person and examples of their work. But the thing that wins it over for me is that every time there's a slightly different format. So in the case of Chris Ware, there's a big fold-out of there's lots of examples of his work.
This is absolutely fantastic. I've never seen this.
The Dave Eggers issue is interesting because it folds out to be a big poster, which is like a big map. Got that one here. So they all start the same size and the same premise, but they all develop and grow up into, you know, they all fold out into different things. And it makes the best use of print and format.
It's really inspiring to see that, you know, publishers are investing this much care and craft to magazines.
Well, it's the bastion, really, isn't it, against digital? When you put so much work into creating something that is much more than just a read or a flick through...
What?
Become something collectible.
Well, I think it's really, I mean, that's the point. If you're going to print something, it has to be special enough to justify its existence in print. I think too much print is just made to just be
disposable,
and that's a real shame. It's missing the opportunity.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Jeremy Leslie, for coming in and sharing your pick of the magazines. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this. Do That was Pushing On by Freddy Krueger featuring Lynn. You're listening to The Review. We'll be back in a moment. Now, as London gears up for the Olympics, hotel rooms are being snapped up all over the capital. One of the most coveted is a new temporary one-bedroom apartment in a boat, marooned on the roof of the South Bank Centre, with some of the finest views across London. It opened for business this week and is the work of the young, brilliant architect David Cohn. He joins us on the line now. David, maybe you could just start by telling us a little bit about the project and how you came to be involved and what it consists of exactly.
Sure. So the project started with a competition that was run by Living Architecture and Art Angel that provided this incredible site on the roof of the South Bank with these views, and the invitation to create a place where visitors could reflect on their relationship to London and to the wider world in the Olympic year. And there was also encouragement to collaborate with artists because of the relationship to Art Angel. And so we teamed up with Fiona Banner and developed the proposal that's on the roof today.
And have you stayed on the boat yourself yet?
Yes, I was there 5th of January, had a great evening. It's extraordinary for the fact that the city is kind of teeming around you.
It's rush really, hour, yeah, one of the most incredible sights in London, and such a fantastic opportunity to be able to actually sort of work on something like that, I presume.
Yes, no, it has been wonderful.
Can you tell me a little bit, so as an architect, so did you build the boat from scratch, or were you involved in just the whole sort of beautiful refurbishment of it, and what were the sort of design architecture choices you made for this very, very specific project?
Well, we knew that we should build it off-site, because it's such a difficult site to build on.
A roof of a building. Yeah, yeah.
And so we then realised that building it off-site would mean necessarily a journey to London to install it. And that fitted very well with the idea of a travel to the site, and then the Thames being the reason London is there led to the idea of it being a boat. And then we tried to layer stories on it to do with travel from London historically, and Fiona and I became very interested in the relevance of Heart of Darkness, the Conrad novel, and we found images of the boat that Conrad captained himself up the Congo, and all of these different fragments of description of a vessel we pieced together, and then we worked very closely with a fabricator called Millimeter in Brighton, who were extraordinary. I mean, so skilled, and we built it from scratch, and the structure had to be made to ensure that it doesn't fall into the concert hall below during a performance. So it had to be very specific for that roof.
And it's been open for bookings for the first half of the year, and they sold out in record time. I think as bookings for the second half of the year, have they opened already as well?
No, that's on the 19th.
On the 19th, I'm going to be sure to...
You can book online, and it's 6 months' worth of nights still available.
And people can stay there for one night only, is that right?
That's right. There is another public angle to the project, which is that Art Angel are hosting 1 week in every month performances and writers in residence, and those performances are actually beamed live into venues on the South Bank and online, so that, for example, David Byrne will be performing in the boat. And from our perspective, it's wonderful that it has this kind of it's like a very small theatre, as well as being a room to stay in.
And tell us a little bit about the interior of it. I mean, there are pictures all over the internet, but you've sort of managed to capture this very sort of poetic sense. You mentioned the inspiration of The Heart of Darkness by Conrad, but it also feels rather Scandinavian.
Well, we were... I think from the outside, you very much see it as a singular object. You know, it's a boat on a roof, and I think we wanted to ensure that from the inside it was something unexpected. So whilst it's comfortable and you has all the things you need to spend the night or longer, we wanted it to have a slightly uncanny feel. So a lot of the colours of the finishes, the way the interior is actually broken down into several small rooms. So whilst it looks like one thing from the outside, in fact there's about four rooms inside with divisions between them, so that the experience of being on board is much more multiple than you'd expect. So there are different rooms that are given over to different activities. So the room on top, which arguably has has the highest view, certainly, that has a writer's desk and a library of books and a trap door so you can really cut yourself off completely.
Yeah.
And, that's a space quite different to the galley kitchen, which is a bit more domestic and relaxed.
David, I love the idea that I'm not sure whether it's a rule or whether just guests are encouraged to write about their experiences. And it sort of touches on the whole transient nature of hotel rooms and contemplation. Are you reading what people are writing as they write?
So far, I stayed a night and with Marguerite, my wife, and we filled in the logbook for that day. And then I think the next night was Fiona Banner and her husband filled it in, and then Alain de Botton and his wife. So that I've managed to read those three, and it's very entertaining because, of course, the boat can't travel, but in the manner of a traditional logbook, the invitation is to write about your direction, the weather patterns, what the water is doing, and of course everything takes on both a literal and a metaphorical meaning, and it's quite comic in parts and very moving.
I can see a book.
Oh, I absolutely love it, David. Just finally, I wonder if you could tell us what will happen to the boat when the year is up.
Well, there's I have a great hope that it will travel and
down the Thames.
Well, hopefully it'll be put onto something that floats down the Thames and out of London and to other countries. And there are conversations about that. I don't think anything's fixed yet. But, the prospect of it kind of docking in Cape Town or Hong Kong or Lisbon would be lovely.
Fantastic. Well, booking opens for the second half of the year on the 19th of January, and I will be first in line. Gillian, you probably will be too.
Or if not, a call out for any guests who do get tickets to invite Hugo and me for dinner.
Exactly. I promise to write something witty in the logbook. David Cohn, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here. Our producer was Marcus Hippie. Our sound engineer was Frank McWeeny. You've been listening to The Review with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Gillian DeBias. Next week, Monocle 24 is going to have a series of special programmes as the team hits the road across Europe. On Monday, The Briefing will be broadcast live from Milan. And on Tuesday and Wednesday, Midori House will be hosted live from Zurich. So be sure to tune in. Next up at the top of the hour is the news with Gwennon Edwards, but we're going to leave you with a song. This is Animal by Mika Snow.